Welcome to the Conestoga Podcast. This is Program 24 for March 15, 2007. Conestoga is Oklahoma's largest literary science fiction and fantasy convention. And it's time, once again, for another podcast recorded at Conestoga 10. This was the very first podcast recorded at the convention. Of course, it wasn't the first one released. So now I have the pleasure of bringing you one of our regular local guests, Marty Belsky, whose history, as a longtime fan, a professor of law, and author makes him an astute commentator on the state of science fiction, its past, present, and future. Welcome to Conestoga. We are no longer recording. We are no longer recording podcasts before the convention, so we are now live at the convention. Of course, you'll hear this later when it's posted online. I'm Chris Merle, your podcast host, and I have my very first guest. Although you may not hear it in order when it's actually posted, I have Marty Belsky, whose day job he is a law professor. He's also a former dean, and he even hosted his own radio show for 12 years. He does have a little fiction published, but I think he could probably best called as a commentator on printed science fiction. And I want to welcome you this afternoon.
Thanks, Chris. Glad to be here.
Okay. Well, we were talking a little bit earlier about the changes that you've seen in science fiction over the last, I guess, two or three decades, although you've probably been reading a little bit longer than that. One of the things you mentioned was you were reading all the magazines. What magazines were you reading?
Well, growing up and then into my early adult years, I would subscribe to Fantasy and Science Fiction. I would subscribe to Omni. I would subscribe to Analog. I would subscribe to the Isaac Asimov Science Fiction magazine. And I'd usually find five or six or seven articles, you know, or stories in each one that I'd like to follow. And then there'd be a few that are more speculative, and then there'd be sort of feature articles on the side, which I was the kind of personality I'd always skip by, except I like to read the biographies of people who wrote. And I found more recently that if I buy those magazines or if I look at those magazines, there's maybe one article in every other volume that I enjoy. The rest of them just seem to be sort of speculative fantasy, which is something that I don't enjoy as much.
Do you find yourself trying to go back and reading the older stuff, or do you constantly look for new stuff?
I have this new thing, which I'm doing a lot, which is that I do a lot of running and I do a lot of driving, and I now have an MP3 player and an audiobook, so I actually get unabridged versions. For example, I just recently listened to the unabridged version of the Foundation series, the entire Foundation series, all over again. And in addition, there are a series of radio shows from the 50s, 60s, and 70s, including some from Britain, which are unabridged sort of stories that come from science fiction, which you can listen to and do. And I have, in fact, gone back and started to read some of the old science fiction books I used to read, and also read some of the old science fiction magazines that I used to read in the past.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Foundation, do you know who reads that, the one you've been listening to, the Foundation series?
I should know the person's name. I don't remember the person's name.
Well, I remember back in the 70s, there were a lot of I believe it was Cademon, or I can't even pronounce it correctly. I'll put it in the show notes later. But there were a series of LPs, and William Shatner did readings of excerpts.
No. There's a separate CD, which is also an Audible, mm-hmm. where Shatner read something, Leonard Nimoy read something, and a couple other people read something, and they read short excerpts. These are unabridged versions, and mm-hmm. I know it's not Shatner. I would recognize Shatner's
yes.
voice. And I forget who. It's somebody who reads a mm-hmm. lot of these unabridged versions, not necessarily someone who reads a lot of science fiction. It's the same kind of person who reads unabridged sort of mystery novels or unabridged history novels. There's a whole group of those people who do it on a regular basis and make their living that way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I was just going to back up a little bit on the Shatner read, I think it was the Mule excerpt
right.
From the Foundation trilogy, and Nimoy read a number of Bradbury and
right.
Heinlein stories.
Right.
And those are, if you can find them, listen to them, they're
well,
great.
Well, they're available on audible.com.
Oh, they are now?
Yeah.
Okay, good, so people can go get them now. Now, the story you wrote was, what, Advocates for Peace?
Advocates for Peace. The premise was relatively straightforward, and I wrote it as a relatively young lawyer. I was a prosecutor, and I was working in Philadelphia, and I was a trial lawyer, and I would see these situations where people would come in and make their case and make their argument, and then all of a sudden they would switch their roles and make the different argument on the other sides. And the premise is relatively straightforward. The premise was that an individual was arguing before the world community
mm-hmm.
who was watching it on TV, we were primitive in those days. We didn't have computers and technology and podcasts.
Yep.
They're watching it on TV, and the first they would do it in Country X, let's say America.
Mm-hmm.
And then they say America. As a matter of fact, the countries they pick were America and Russia, that they were deciding to vote to go to war or not to go to war. And so the advocate was someone who would advocate not going to war in one country, and then his other side would be advocating to go to war,
mm-hmm.
and then they would switch roles going to the other country and make the same arguments. And I left it sort of open at the end what actually happened in the hopes that somebody would want me to write a sequel, but nobody ever did. And I was talking about trying to show the lawyer-like skills, the kind of argument. What's really fascinating was I think what actually got me thinking about this and actually writing it was there was a Star Trek episode about 2 years earlier
uh-huh.
where they had somebody defending, I think it was either Wilney Shatner or Leonard Nimoy, in which he talked about all these various constitutional
yes.
rights. Remember that episode?
Yeah, I can't remember the name of the episode, and it's but I'll put it in the show notes. I think the character's name was Theodore T. Cogswell.
Right, that's right. I remember that.
And I just remember the scene where he's going about, he was pointing at the computer.
The Code of Hammurabi and the Code mm-hmm. of all this stuff like that, and somebody had messed up the computer tape,
mm-hmm.
and they had sort of put, I think, Bill Shatner, mm-hmm. William Shatner, Captain Kirk, into this premise. And that sort of thought me about, well, why shouldn't there be more legal science fiction? Why mm-hmm. can't we have a lot more of what's going to be like to be a lawyer in 2050 or 2100 or 2200 and on the world stage?
Well, now I remember the name of the episode. It's Court Martial okay. was the name mm-hmm. of the episode. And I know someone who hasn't seen it who is a lawyer that I will have to foist it upon her later.
Okay. But I thought at one point I'd be writing a whole bunch of stuff, mm-hmm. and then my life went sort of – I went to Washington to work on the impeachment. That sort of diverted me mm-hmm. for a while.
Yeah. Well, let's hope we don't see a repeat of the 70s, but we'll see. Yeah, but you do have quite an impressive list of publications here because I printed it off and took a look at it. So if you're interested in legal stuff, you can find quite a bit that he's actually written on various legal topics. Now, of course, I've seen you on various panels at Conestoga because you've been coming for a number of years, and there was one panel last year that I didn't get a chance to finish, and it was very interesting because the panel last year there was two things that stood out about it. All the panelists except one was very pessimistic about the future of humanity and the future of the Earth, and two, they weren't used to confrontation and debate.
This doesn't sound at all like me. I must have been the exception to the rule.
and of course, you know, being a law professor and being a lawyer, you know, debate is your bread and butter.
Right.
So I was really surprised too that they were also pessimistic because a lot of times, even though the science fiction writers, they write about very dark and dim futures, some also write some very positive pieces, but knowing that there are a lot of trials ahead of us.
Well, I think there's been a radical change. If you read some of the stuff coming out now, people are more pessimistic after 9/11. People mm-hmm. are more concerned. I think the Iraq war doesn't help. I think the war in the Middle East doesn't help as well. It's hard to be optimistic. I am still an optimist in the long mm-hmm. run. I'm scared to death in the short term, but I'm an optimist in the long run. I basically believe that we are smart and intelligent and radical. If we look back to how close we came to the end of mankind at the Cuban Missile Crisis, which we now know.
Yes.
How close we came to the end of that, and we survived that, that makes me sort of somewhat optimistic. I also believe science fiction, good science fiction, gives us hope. It says there is a future, most times. Mm-hmm. It doesn't talk about going back to decimate the past, and it says that we're going to be getting better and better. You know, some of it talks about being only creatures of the mind, not having corporal existences, but it does talk about something optimistic. I also believe that science fiction, which I have never met someone who writes in a science fiction area who doesn't believe that there are not other intelligent life forms.
Mm-hmm.
I've never met a science fiction writer who doesn't believe there's not some other intelligent life form, with one exception, and that's Isaac Asimov. Isaac Asimov's theory is that they all came from mm-hmm. this country and this world, but other than him, and so if you believe there's other life forms out there, or even if you're a science fiction believer only in Isaac Asimov, that we're going to spread out into space. And again, remember, I was raised in the era of the 60s and 50s mm-hmm. where we saw all these amazing things happening like Sputnik and Man on the Moon and stuff like that. So I really believe that that leads to optimism. But you're right. There are many people mm-hmm. in the panel I was just in today here, which was on TV in the past year, a very pessimistic panel.
Yeah, especially I've been watching Battlestar Galactica, and yes, it's a very dark series. One of the things is that people that are not optimistic about the future or optimistic about, you know, eventually contacting other races, I want to explain something. There's a thing called the Drake Equation, which the astronomer, he came up with an equation for the likelihood of other intelligent civilizations in the galaxy. And there could be as few as one other, or one as us, or there could be, you know, thousands, depending on the various parameters. Another famous scientist, Fermi, he goes, well, where are they, is what he was asking. And one civilization, because the galaxy is so old, billions of years old, and since it's billions of years old, that even one civilization that reaches space travel capability could cross the galaxy, even if they traveled at 1% the speed of light, they could spread out across a galaxy within a couple million years. And since the galaxy is billions of years old, you know, the question is, well, where are they? And so that is also one of the great mysteries. But I think we just don't have enough information yet. We're only just now exploring and listening and looking. And so we don't know what the reasons are why we haven't found any yet, because, I mean, we've only started looking like in the blink of an eye, and you're not going to see anything for a while yet. I think it's going to take a while before we find other civilizations.
But Christian, there's two conflicting theories of mm-hmm. other civilizations. There's the other civilizations, which are planets in other galaxies and in the universe, and then there's the alternative universes, that we have various dimensions, that there's somebody just like you or me doing similar things, but not exactly the same thing, in an alternative dimension. You see those both in science fiction.
Yes.
And both exist and both coexist in sort of different genres of the same idea. I don't think we're going to live long enough to see the dimension idea, the concept of dimension idea. And the other issue is, I mean, there's a leap of faith in science fiction that we're going to be able to go faster than the speed of light. Most science fiction sort of talks about that, or they talk about the idea that your body slows down so long, like Joe Haldeman series, where, you know, your body slows down because you get close to the speed of light that you can sort of survive and do things on the outside. But if we have at the other end of the universe somebody who's spreading, we might not know it for another billion years ourselves. Of course, that belies the whole idea of people who don't believe in evolution, but that's another story itself.
Yeah, well, we won't talk about them. Although I've had my debates with people that have alternative views on how science works. One of my favorite nonfiction commentators is Richard Feynman, and every time I listen to his tapes, it's very clear as to what science is and what it isn't. And he talks about cargo cult science, people that they go through the motions of doing scientific experiments, or they use the words, but they're not actually doing real science.
Well, that's what the phrase was. Another person used, result-oriented science.
Mm-hmm.
Where they want the results they're going to do, so they manipulate the science to get to that, as compared to science. I mean, a good example of that is theory. When a scientist talks about evolution being a theory, what he or she is saying is that, to our knowledge base today, it is as close to reality as we can do it. If you talk to someone who's an anti-evolutionist, a creationist, when they say, oh, theory, that means it's just a hypothesis. It's something that just may or may not exist. It's a total misunderstanding of the concept. And we're going to have to overcome that over time.
Well, someone explained to me, well, you can tell them atomic theory is just a theory, and then you can ask the survivors of Hiroshima if atomic theory is just a theory.
Right.
So that doesn't shut them up, but it does start to make them think.
I'm really interested. I really wonder if we're going to start seeing what I'll call Christian right science fiction. This Born Again, that's not Born Again, this, what's it, the Risen Again series, what's it?
Left Behind series.
Left Behind series.
By LaHaye.
Is in some ways science fiction. In some ways it is speculative fantasy, and I think you're going to find more and more of that. Mm-hmm. Will the science fiction community accept that as science fiction? Will they accept it as speculative fiction? I think there's going to be a left-wing, right-wing sort of dispute over what the future of science fiction is.
Yeah. Well, we could go into the discussion of what art is. I mean, if art serves a particular purpose, it could be either didactic, where they're trying to get across a particular political viewpoint. Michael Crichton is a good example of that recently with, I think, State of Fear. Or is it art? You know, if you read like James Joyce or even Walter Miller Jr., But speaking of writers that are fairly faithful, I know C.S. Lewis, you know, his stuff kind of beat you over the head with the religion.
Right.
But J.R.R. Tolkien, who was a devout Catholic, his religion suffused The Lord of the Rings, but he didn't beat you over the head with it the way C.S. Lewis does. And Walter Miller Jr. was also a devout Catholic, but his but he didn't come across as being preachy. You know, it informed his writing, but it wasn't like you have to believe this way. Whereas, unlike like the Left Behind series, obviously they want you to believe a certain way and agree with their views.
Right, and but again, that is changing, and that is they are pushing that agenda fairly strongly, and it's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen with some of that. And some of the miracle shows on TV, that come out is. We would classify that the equivalent of, science fiction, where you have things occurring outside the norms, paranormal behavior.
Uh-huh.
And yet they are trying to excel it as not being paranormal. It's just the divine intervention. What one person's called divine intervention, another person calls paranormal. Where you stand depends on where you sit, was what Yogi Berra, that famous science fiction writer, once said.
Yeah. Now, the panel you were just on, I guess let's change the subject a little bit here. You were talking about the television being pessimistic. What were some of the television series that you had discussed?
I tried to raise the point that what's happened in the last couple of years is there's been two sort of changes in science fiction on TV. One, there have been the superpower science fiction.
Right.
We have The Medium. We have Psych, which is a satire. We have Dead Zone. Where even Smallville, we have a situation where what we're trying to do is create a personality, and they're giving him a superpower. That's one set of science fiction. We have some carryover space opera, Battleship Galactica, but even that's a carryover, and they've changed it dramatically. And Star Trek is gone, and sort of even Stargate Atlantis is much different than Stargate. It's much more character driven than Stargate, which was much more sort of soap opera, sort of space opera stuff. And then you have what I'll call the continuing mystery. 4400 is a good example of that. Lost is another example of that, where you have a whole set of stories which is unraveling over time, but try to figure out what force there is behind what's going on. What is real? And Eureka, which has just started a couple weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
What is really going on behind the scenes? What abnormal, what extraterrestrial, what alternative situations happening? So we have these two trends. But the historic science fiction of TV is basically Star Trek is gone.
Uh-huh.
Battleship Galactica is all but gone, in my opinion. And Stargate and Stargate Atlantis are sort of, repeating themselves again and again. And so we have this sort of supernormal and also what's behind kind of stuff going science fiction. What I found interesting in this group is how few of the people on my panel had watched TV have watched these shows on TV as compared to people who wait the season is over and then buy the DVD collection.
I've been doing that recently with a number of shows. We did the Galactica, although one of the series that I thought was very good hard science fiction was Babylon 5.
Right.
And it had a positive future in it. However, they went through a lot of trials and tribulations to get to that positive
future. Are you aware that we were just told that there's going to be a series of direct DVD Babylon series?
Yeah, I did just read that Straczynski is going to be doing some more Babylon 5 stuff, which I'm very glad about. And, of course, he's not going to recast the characters that were played by Richard Biggs or Andrew Katsoulis, because what I read was he kept on insisting being dead, which...
the other thing that's interesting is that, and this is why I think science fiction is going to flourish in the visual media, especially TV, there's three things going on. One is you don't need as big an audience. Star Trek would have survived today if we had all the cable stations.
Yeah.
It would have moved from NBC to Sci-Fi or A&E or USA Today or TNT. And I think it would have survived for many more years. That's first of all. Second of all, there is a massive DVD audience that will watch it. And then we also have the national audience. The people in Japan, if you go to Japan, I was in Europe recently, in other places, they have a lot of American TV, and they gobble it up. They gobble up Star Trek. And they gobble up Stargate, and they gobble up, they even gobble up the really old science fiction. We're talking about Tom Corbett Space Cadets.
Wow.
And so they gobble that. And Europe's the same way. I mean, Doctor Who coming back again, and Doctor Who, the new sort of new iteration. I really think overseas, the internationalization of science fiction, I think, is going to be a factor. So between DVDs, cable, I think you're going to see a big growth in visual science fiction. Books are a different issue. And I mean by that, our kids are not reading. You and I used to read, which there's now, however, if you get any of these magazines, which I get, an awful lot of science fiction on tape or CDs. Or I have an MP3, you can get audible.com, that's a plug.
Yep.
but there's similar ones like that. Amazon does the same thing for getting it on a pod, an iPod or MP3 player. And what's happening is more and more people listen to unabridged stories and listening to those things and listening to that. And hopefully some of those people will get so excited about it and start reading it again.
Well, that's what got me started. The two things that were, for me, because I was only 6 years old in 1969, the two things that got me onto science fiction and science was I got to watch the moon landing. My father woke me up to make sure, watch Neil Armstrong step out.
Right.
And then Star Trek. I didn't realize until years later that I actually got to see the third season of Star Trek when it was first aired. And so that got me hooked. And then there was comic books. And I know some people remain comic book fans all their lives, but I always felt like they were a gateway to written science fiction.
I learned to read on some comic books. I was a DC Comics fiend. I watched Superman, Batman, all those things. Captain Marvel. People don't remember Captain Marvel that well. But I learned to read. I started reading when 3 years old and sort of picked up words. DC Comics used to have a policy. Because they were trying to do some TV code, some code of moral authority, where they would add 15 to 20 vocabulary words in every issue. Mm-hmm. And so I learned to read that way.
And the anthology that hooked me on to written science fiction was an anthology edited by Damon Knight called Beyond Tomorrow. It had a story by whom? Edited by Damon Knight. It had the short story. It had Nightfall by Isaac Asimov.
Right.
It had Desertion by Clifford Simak, which was one of the city stories. And had Twilight by Don A. Stewart, which is a.k.a. John W. Campbell.
Right.
And that one, that changed my world, and then I just fell in love with science fiction. I've been hooked ever since.
I started by reading Analog, which was the old Amazing Science Fiction, and then from that moved on to Isaac Asimov. I thought Isaac Asimov was one of the best ones that existed for a long period of time. I think, didn't Ben Bova do it for a while? Wasn't he the editor for a while?
No, Sithers was the first editor. I know there was a Kathleen Maloney. Then Dozois had it for a really long time.
Right.
And I'm not sure who the name of the editor is right now.
Okay.
But Ben Bova did edit Analog for a while.
And they also edited, he did Omni.
Yes, he did Omni. I think he might have been the first editor, too.
Right.
And I have some of those early Omni issues, and I will try to find your story.
I've moved three or four times. It's somewhere there. Advocates for Peace.
Advocates for Peace.
And maybe what I should try to do is try to write it again. If you don't remember it, nobody's ever seen it, maybe I could write it again.
Well, you could always find another marker for it, too.
Right.
The other thing, too, we'll be talking about this in our panel tomorrow, is that a lot of authors are using, there's a thing called podiobooks.com. They have a print novel, but they want to help increase the sales of it, so they do readings of it, and they will read a chapter, post it online, and people can subscribe to them and listen to them. And one of the guests tomorrow, she's doing that right now, so with one of her novels. So, and some of the authors seems to be helping driving their sales.
Well, it'd be nice, but again, there's a lot of people out there. You know, my children, you know, don't read. They just don't read, like, you know, for pleasure. I mean, and they listen to a lot of audio stuff. And they will listen to audio books. They just don't read. I find that strange. I wonder if that's common, not just to my family, but to generally.
Well, one of the things I've discovered is I've started listening to podcasts. Most of them tend to be political or science related, but it's actually driven me to buy a number of books. They're nonfiction books, so I think if the podcast is done right and you have the right guests and stuff and so forth, you could probably get people intrigued in reading a particular author. I don't know how it's going to work with fiction, but at least with nonfiction, it works with me.
Can you download a podcast?
Yes.
So that people can sort of listen to them when they drive long distances, or put in their MP3 player or their iPod.
Yeah, it's like there's iTunes, which you can subscribe to various feeds. The thing is, internet audio has been around for a long time, but what podcasting does, it puts it in a serial format so that with the right software, you can subscribe to the podcast. You then download it to your computer. You can then put it on your iPod or other MP3 player, burn it to a CD, or even listen to it on your computer, and it becomes portable. And there are a fair number of podcasts now, science fiction related. There are only two convention podcasts, Conestoga and Balticon podcasts so far, but there's quite a few sci-fi related podcasts, mostly fan oriented, and we'll mention those in another.
Are there fanzines that are podcasts yet?
Yeah, there's a couple of fan podcasts. Some of them talk about Firefly and Battlestar Galactica.
Right, they're specifically oriented.
Or comic books or anime. There's even podcasts that there's a Slice of Sci-Fi, which talks about, they interview television stars. And then they also do another one called Cover to Cover, where they interview authors about their books. As a matter of fact, Cover to Cover, which is Michael and Evo, they the author who passed away not too recently. It's not Connie Willis. It was a lady author. She's black. I can't remember.
Oh, I think I know what you mean, but
yeah.
I don't know.
But they actually interviewed her 2 weeks before she passed away.
Oh, wow.
And so it was a very good interview. And I apologize for not remembering her name. So maybe I'll just insert it later.
That's amazing technology.
Yes. I haven't had to do that yet. I've had to move stuff around a little bit in these podcasts. Usually what I do is I just chop stuff out. And it's amazing what editing can do to a podcast.
It's amazing what editing can do to anything you record.
Yes.
You can create something completely different than what the person said.
Well, I haven't done that yet, although I may be committing more of a sin by omission than a sin by commission. So, well, let's see. How long have we gone? We've gone on for about 31 minutes, although we'll probably chop out about 5 minutes. So we've got well over 20 minutes worth of material here. I can't think of anything else right now to talk to you about, but you're really fun to talk to, Marty.
Because I just one thing, which is, you know, I would like to sort of, I would love to see conferences like this done on computer, like what I call a visual podcast. I don't know if that exists yet.
Yes, it does.
And where, you know, you could have the various panels and stuff can go on and have people watch it. I think, you know, because of the cost of gas and transportation and time and stuff, if we can sort of think that way, I am in my 60s, so maybe I'm too old for me, but even I like to think that way. If we can think that way of sort of having these things be available and charging a fee, not an expensive fee because you have to do the kinds of stuff like that, you could get large numbers of people who could do it. Now, you don't get the interaction. I'm not talking about you still need to come. It's like I like to watch a movie in a movie theater.
Right.
Or I like to go see a play in a theater. But every once in a while, I don't mind watching a DVD. And I don't mind watching sort of a play at a local playhouse. But I think putting those two things together, I think, would be very useful, especially with science fiction, because science fiction does translate from society to society. Unlike a murder mystery, have you ever tried to read a murder mystery done by someone who is a Japanese author? You can't follow it. If you've ever tried to read an adventure story by someone who comes from South Africa, you can't read it. But you can read science fiction from wherever they come from.
Oh, yeah. I've read a lot of translation. I've read some the Strugatsky
Brothers.
R.U.R.
is still one of the best robot stories ever. You know, and it's just, you know, it's just amazing. And you can get Lem stuff, Stanislaw Lem stuff from Russia. I mean, it's just spectacular stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, we lost him this year as well. I love the Perks the Pilot stories.
Yeah. Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, thank you very much, Marty, and I'll let you know when this is posted.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Marty. He's always interesting to talk to and a panelist who isn't afraid to shake things up. I wanted to let our listeners know there are just a few more podcasts from Conestoga 10 to be posted, and then it'll be time to start with the podcasts leading up to Conestoga 11. I already have one recorded with Elizabeth Moon, so you can certainly look forward to it. And speaking of looking forward, Conestoga 11 is less than 5 months away and we have a lot in store. Stay subscribed for the details. So thanks for listening until our next Conestoga podcast. For more information, our web address is www.sftulsa.org or send an email to conestoga@sftulsa.org. Questions about our podcast may be sent to podcast@sftulsa.org. Please send us an email or put a comment on the website and let us know what you thought of this podcast.